Central Time, I'm Judith Sears-Poisson. You're with us here on the Ideas Network. Coming up, what's behind the rise in Lyme disease in Wisconsin? We'll take a closer look at what the research shows coming up shortly. Now it's time for our weekly check-in on the latest in national politics. Over the last week, it's been up in the air whether or not the United States will meet with North Korea to negotiate denuclearization. It seemed as though the original summit was called off, but a top-ranking North Korean diplomat is now apparently en route to the U.S. We'll break all of that down in a minute and take your calls about the North Korean summit at 800-642-1234. Do you think it will happen? Are you hopeful that negotiations will work and there will be a summit? Do you think it should be a top priority for the Trump administration and their diplomatic efforts? Give us a call at 800-642-1234. Also, the midterm elections are heating up. There are a few crucial Senate seats that could swing the balance of partisan power, and President Trump is on the campaign trail to stump for GOP candidates. Later, we'll get an update on the Russia investigation and hear about the president's reaction to ABC's cancellation of Roseanne. Callum Borchers is a reporter covering the intersection of politics and the media for The Fix at The Washington Post. Callum, welcome back to Central Time.
Glad to be back.
Let's start with some domestic politics. President Trump is on the campaign trail to stump for GOP candidates that are coming up in the midterm elections. He was at a campaign rally in Tennessee yesterday for Senate candidate Marsha Blackburn. She's currently serving in the House and is being challenged by former mayor and governor Phil Bredesen. First, why is this Tennessee race so significant?
Well, it's significant because it's remarkable. The Democrats think they have a shot to win in that state at all. This is, of course, a deep red state that ought to be a reliable win for Republicans. And that does not appear to be the case right now. Blackburn has the edge in many polls, but it is hardly the slam dunk that one might expect. And so the mere fact that the president felt compelled to go to Tennessee to campaign on her behalf is notable.
Let's take a listen to President Trump at a rally yesterday talking about Blackburn's rival.
So Marsha's very liberal Democrat opponent, Phil Bredesen. I never heard of this guy. Who is he? Who is he? He's an absolute total tool of Chuck Schumer. He's a tool of Chuck Schumer, and of course, the MS-13 lover, Nancy Pelosi.
So, Callum, this sort of campaigning has worked well for President Trump in the past. What does he hope to accomplish with statements like that? Pretty inflammatory statements.
They are. And if you notice, there's sort of a fundamental inconsistency there that I'm sure he's hoping that listeners won't pick up on, which is one, he says he's never even heard of this guy, suggesting I don't know anything about him. But oh, by the way, I can tell you that he is a tool of Chuck Schumer and Nancy Pelosi. And it's, well, so which is it? You know something about the guy or you've never even heard of him. But that doesn't matter, right? And so he does this a lot. He sort of gives his supporters two options, and they are mutually exclusive if you're thinking logically. But if you're not, you can just sort of pick one, and either one makes the opponent look bad.
Well, and these kind of rallies are obviously playing to a base. They're not, you know, talking to undecided voters. People who are there to hear it are probably already decided on supporting the candidate that the president is stumping for. But how does this kind of message play perhaps outside of that core group of people who are going to support what the president says?
Well, that's a good question. The answer is probably that it is not terribly effective, but the second part of that answer is that it may not matter to the president. What he is looking for here is to hold this one specific seat with one slice of the electorate, and the broader view is not terribly important to him. And the thing I think that's important to keep in mind in this race, too, is that one of the reasons that he really wants Marsha Blackburn to win this race is that Blackburn is far more sympathetic to him than the current holder of the seat, who is, of course, Bob Corker. Mm-hmm. At one time, Corker was considered a potential running mate for Donald Trump. And then once Trump actually got into office, as we all know, Corker has become one of the most outspoken critics of the president within the Republican Party. So the president is eager to get Corker out the door and to get somebody like Blackburn in his place.
So as you said, some Republicans, pretty substantial Republicans like Bob Bob Corker, have distanced themselves from President Trump. Those are sitting Republicans. There are also Republican candidates who are choosing to kind of keep the president a little arm's distance. How is it breaking down who decides to encourage support from President Trump and welcome that, and who kind of backs off a little bit?
It's very state by state, isn't it? And you're right. You see a real spread of different strategies across the country. And a lot of it has to do with just looking back at 2016 and how did the president fare in each of those states. And you see this trend where in states where the president won big, in some cases, Republicans in primaries recently, we've seen them sort of elbowing each other out of the way to each claim that he or she is the biggest Trump fan on planet Earth. You've seen people with their campaign ads where they're wearing their Make America Great Again hats. And then there are other states where the president didn't fare nearly as well, and they're not running that way at all. In fact, they are very noticeably keeping a distance from the president. A terrific example, and a high-profile one, of course, is Mitt Romney's bid for a Senate seat in Utah. Utah, as we know, is a very red state, but not a red state that likes this president very much. In fact, he fared very poorly there during the Republican primary in 2016. And so you had this striking moment just a couple of days ago with Romney on the campaign trail, sort of coaxing his crowd to give a round of applause to journalists who were covering the event and talking about his love and respect for the First Amendment, just about the most opposite thing someone could do at a campaign rally from what you see Donald Trump do at his rallies.
So, Callum, you and your team at The Fix have pointed to four races that could shift power in the Senate. Which races are those?
Well, one is, of course, that Tennessee race that we were talking about earlier. And if Democrats were to win that one, I think that would be a huge, significant shift for the landscape, because you got to remember that the Democrats are hoping to take over really both houses of Congress this year if they could. And that would set up a really difficult fight potentially for the president heading into 2020.
And we're talking about ways that the Senate can shift. Are there states where Democrats are vulnerable that Republicans might be able to even out some of those losses they might be facing?
Well, West Virginia is one that comes to mind right away. And, of course, Joe Manchin, the Democrat, is trying to hold on to a Senate seat there. And he is sort of a unique Democrat in some ways, because he is someone who has not been the forceful critic of President Trump that you've seen other members of his party be. In fact, I can remember a distinct moment at a roundtable discussion at the White House just a couple of months ago talking about gun control, and Joe Manchin sort of heaping praise on the president during that televised event. And you've seen him. He's one of the few Democrats who's willing to appear regularly on Fox News. And so that is a state that would be perhaps inclined to go red. Manchin is kind of, I guess, what you'd call a purple Democrat as is. But Republicans see that as a potential vulnerability where they could turn maybe a sympathetic Democrat into a more zealous pro-Trump Republican.
And before we move on to other topics, Callum, you know, we're about 5 months out from the midterm elections, away from the general election. What are you and your team at The Fix going to be watching for as these races progress?
I think what we're looking for is indicators that might look ahead to what we can predict in 2020. And it sounds early already, and yet these races seem to, these election cycles seem to start earlier and earlier every 4 years. And I think that what we're all trying to get a sense of in 2018 is just how big of a difference, if any, do we see from 2016 as a foreshadowing. It's typical that the party in power will lose some seats in the midterm. You've seen the president talk about this a lot when he's out in public. He talks to his supporters about fighting complacency, as he puts it. He says that the party in power, especially the one that holds the White House, tends to lose their enthusiasm. He very badly wants his supporters to not let that happen. And so I think that's one of the things that we're really keeping an eye on. Is the president able to sort of keep the faith among his base and get them to turn out in a midterm election when perhaps history suggests that they will stay home and allow Democrats to make gains?
Kellen Borchers is a reporter covering the intersection of politics and the media for The Fix at The Washington Post. He's with us for our weekly look at some of the biggest national political stories. And Kellen, let's move on to the Russia investigation. The Russia investigation has been underway for about a year now. There have been some arrests made of former Trump campaign officials. Where are we right now with the investigation? What seems to be the focus at this point?
At the moment, the focus appears to be more on obstruction of justice, or the possibility that the president obstructed justice after becoming president. That's not to say that he has been, or his campaign has been, exonerated of any collusion, much as he loves to say that over and over again. There's no collusion, there's no collusion. We don't know that for certain. In fact, there are indicators that there was at least a willingness to collude. The biggest evidence of that, of course, is Donald Trump Jr. Taking that meeting at Trump Tower in 2016 with a lawyer who he believed was a Russian official who was bringing dirt on Hillary Clinton. But much of the recent reporting from our newsroom and others is that Robert Mueller's team is really zeroing in on the way the president conducted himself in office and whether he was, in fact, trying to disrupt the investigation at a level that would rise to obstruction of justice.
And President Trump tweeted today about his frustration with the ongoing investigation. That's nothing new, but he did specifically talk about his irritation with Attorney General Jeff Sessions' recusal after his appointment. And apparently he tried to convince Jeff Sessions to still oversee the investigation even after that recusal.
Yeah, that was a pretty good scoop by the New York Times last evening, and the president essentially confirming it with his own on-the-record comments about Sessions, who he has said many times before disappointed him by recusing himself from that probe. And, you know, objectively, it's just hard to understand that critique, because Jeff Sessions very clearly would have had at least the appearance of a conflict of interest there. He was a member of the Trump campaign team, a prominent surrogate on the president's behalf. It would have been very difficult for him to at some point deliver the findings of that probe and appear to have been impartial. And yet the president seems to believe that the attorney general ought to be his kind of shield. And he has talked about that over and over again.
House Oversight Committee Chairman Trey Gowdy, a Republican, said yesterday that he was more convinced than ever that the FBI has handled the investigation appropriately. It seems that in some ways, at least, more Republicans are siding with or defending the Mueller investigation and his team. Do you see that as having any impact in how the president and his administration moves forward?
Well, it's hard to say, because Gowdy, like Bob Corker, who we were talking about a moment ago, like Jeff Flake, these are Republicans who, yes, they're being outspoken, but they're also on their way out the door. There are a lot of these Republicans who seem, once they've decided to leave office, liberated to speak their minds about the president. What is a little bit rarer is a Republican who is seeking re-election or who is trying to hold on to power, standing up for the integrity of the investigation. We heard a little bit of that from Mitch McConnell a couple of weeks ago when he said that he supports both investigations, in other words, both the Robert Mueller investigation and the Department of Justice's Inspector General probe, which is looking at how the FBI conducted its investigations during the 2016 campaign. But that was sort of tepid support, and he, like other Republicans in Congress, have been unwilling to support any legislation that would actually protect Robert Mueller from being fired.
We're talking with Kellen Borchers right now. He's a reporter covering the intersection of politics and the media for The Fix at The Washington Post. He's with us to talk about the latest in national politics. After the break, we'll take a look at the latest on the possibility of a U.S.-North Korea summit. And you can join the conversation by calling 800-642-1234. Do you think the North Korea summit is going to happen? And do you think it's helping or hurting the United States that the meeting is in limbo? What do you think of the president's diplomatic strategy as it applies to North Korea? Give us a call at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234, or email us at ideas@wpr.org. We'll pick up the conversation after this short break. Stay with us here on Central Time. Right now, we continue our conversation about the latest in national politics with Callum Borchers. He's a reporter who covers the intersection of politics and the media for The Fix at The Washington Post. And you can join the conversation by calling 800-642-1234. What are your thoughts on the on-again, off-again summit with North Korea? What would you like to see come out of that summit if and when it happens? Give us a call at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Or you can email us at ideas@wpr.org. So, Callum, what is the latest update on, as we said, this very on-again, off-again U.S.-North Korea summit?
I don't know. Check the president's Twitter feed, because that's where the news is coming in. It's been really striking to watch the president kind of act as a one-man news service, which is, I think, what he has always wanted in some ways as far as the way he is covered. You saw this unfolding just yesterday when he was the one to confirm that Kim Jong-chol, the high-ranking North Korean official, was in Beijing and bound for New York to talk about the summit. And the reality is that the president is uniquely positioned as an authoritative source on this matter. It's not a case like we see in some other instances where he just makes assertions that may not be true and they can't change by his own words. In this case, if the president says, yep, I'm willing to take the meeting, well, then it's probably going to happen, unless, of course, Kim Jong-un decides to back out. And so what you have here is the president's sort of emotional vacillation on whether he wants to do this or not really are the story itself. And right now, he seems pretty determined to make it happen.
One of the things that I have found interesting is that after that letter that President Trump sent to Kim Jong-un last week saying, you know, I'm calling this off, you're too angry, there's too much hatred coming at us, I expected a fairly strong reaction from the North Korean side, and it doesn't seem like there was one.
That's right. And this is part of the president's strategy, or at least his claim that it's a strategy, which is I am going to be really aggressive. And that is the only type of rhetoric that a dictator like Kim Jong-un understands and respects. And he believes, the president believes, that that is the way to win this negotiation. That's what he said was behind the little rocket man name calling that he was doing. That was behind the threat last year to wipe North Korea off the face of the earth. I mean, that kind of saber rattling that sort of frightened a lot of other observers, in the president's estimation, is exactly what he needs. And on some level, it appears to be having some effect, because as you said, Judith, the North Koreans did not react with hostility the way one might have expected. In fact, they, if anything, seemed to become a little bit more conciliatory. And this meeting that was called off now looks like it could happen again.
And in preparation for that, as you said, Callum, Kim Jong-chol is on his way to New York. Who is he going to be meeting with?
Well, as we believe, he will be meeting with Mike Pompeo, the Secretary of State, and that is a significant development on its own. Keep in mind that Pompeo has really played a really important role in these negotiations even before he was the Secretary of State, when he was the CIA director. He took at the time, secret mission to North Korea to begin laying the groundwork for these talks, and that was later held up during his confirmation proceedings as a reason that he ought to be confirmed. Essentially, he was already doing the job to some degree. And so that is a significant development. And what I think you see is a president who believes that denuclearizing the North Korean peninsula, the entire Korean peninsula, rather, or at least getting close, would be a major boost for his legacy. Again, I think in some ways it comes back to looking ahead to 2020. And I think he's aware that people will be willing, voters will be willing to overlook a lot. They will overlook perhaps his coarse rhetoric. They will overlook his inability so far to build the border wall that he promised, or to repeal Obamacare the way he promised, if he can have a signature achievement like a major agreement with North Korea.
And before we move on to another topic, Callum, briefly, where is South Korea in all of this?
Well, they seem to be somewhat sidelined, Judith. Recall last week we saw, or a couple weeks ago, when the president called off the meeting with North Korea, South Korea was blindsided by that development. And they seem still to be eager to have North Korea and the United States get together and willing to facilitate that in some role. But it's hard to imagine that South Korea is not feeling a little bit marginalized through the process, or at least a little pushed out of the loop. And I think that's one of the sort of subplots for us all to keep in mind here, is that is the United States going to damage its relationship, which has historically been very good with South Korea, in the process of its effort to reach better terms with North Korea?
And finally, Callum, Roseanne Barr sent a series of racially charged tweets targeting a former Obama administration official, Valerie Jarrett. She caught a lot of flack and very quickly for the tweets. She has apologized kind of, sort of, and blamed Ambien for the tweets. The criticism culminated in not only the cancellation of the very successful reboot of her show Roseanne, she was also dropped by her talent agency. Streaming services are pulling reruns of the original Roseanne. What's the response in Washington to all of this?
Well, I think the thing that we're all struck by today is the president's reaction, which was kind of delayed yesterday when the president was flying aboard Air Force One to Nashville for that rally. Sarah Huckabee Sanders, the press secretary, was asked about the president's response, and she said over and over, he doesn't have one. He's got more important things to worry about. He's working on North Korea. He doesn't spend his time talking about those things. And, of course, he didn't bring up Roseanne at his rally last night. But he couldn't quite help himself. He just had to get on the action on Twitter today. And what he had to say, of course, was about himself. He was not condemning what Roseanne said or even criticizing ABC for yanking her show. He was upset that if ABC was going to apologize to Valerie Jarrett, why haven't they apologized to me for all the terrible things that have been said about me, Donald Trump, on ABC's air?
Well, and do we know what he's referring to specifically?
It was unclear based on the tweet, but we did get some clues in today's media briefing. Sanders was talking about this with reporters, and she did list a few items that could be what he was talking about. For example, she was upset that Joy Behar, one of the hosts of The View, had criticized the president very sharply, I think called him a racist, that Kathy Griffin, the comedian, had done the same thing, and she was upset. Sarah Huckabee Sanders was upset that Griffin had been given a platform by ABC at all, after taking that memorable photo in which she had the mask of President Trump that appeared to be a bloodied, severed head.
Well, Callum, thanks as always for joining us.
Glad to be with you.
Callum Borchers is a reporter covering the intersection of politics and the media for The Fix at The Washington Post. He joined us for our weekly look at some of the top national news stories. We will be taking your calls tomorrow after 4 about the cancellation of Roseanne. Be sure to join us and give us your thoughts.